Hello.
Hello.
I'm Saruti.
I'm Hannah.
And this is the update that you may or may not want. I don't care. It's driven me mad writing it, so you have to listen. On the 12th of November 2024, so the day before we're recording this, 52-year-old Richard Allen was found guilty on all charges in the Delphi case. But if anyone thinks that that means this story is over, think again. There is a lot, and I mean a lot, of controversy surrounding this trial, and people are hugely divided on the outcome. And given that the jury deliberated for 4 days, I don't think it was an easy decision for them either. So in this update, we'll take a look at the trial of Richard Allen, what likely convinced the jury in the end, and just why people are quite so angry.
We are going to give you an extraordinarily quick rundown of the murders themselves, but for the full story, go and listen to the two-parter that we did back in 2022. And also the update on Odinism that we did in September 2023. We will link all of those for you in the show notes.
So for now, let's get on with it because we have a lot to discuss in this update episode. Back on the 13th of February 2017, 13-year-old Abby Williams and 14-year-old Libby German were abducted from the Monon High Bridge in Indiana. Their bodies were found the next day. They had both been brutally murdered, with their throats cut. Now, weird things with this case emerged very quickly. For example, Abby was found wearing Libby's clothes, and Libby was found wearing nothing, and some of their clothes were found in a nearby creek.
Libby's phone was also discovered under her body, and there was video footage shot by Libby of the girls on the bridge, and a strange man, who would become known as Bridge Guy, walking towards them. Then a voice is heard saying, "Guys, down the hill." When we first covered this case, we always said that we'd really want to know what else is on that recording, because only a tiny snippet was released to the public. And now, my friends, we do know. People who are in the courtroom for Richard Allen's trial have reported that it's all just a bit of a jumble. Nothing on the video is super clear. Most of the time, the camera's aimed at the floor. But there is one interesting thing that we'll come to later on.
So for 5 years after Libby and Abby's bodies were found, no one was arrested. Until the shock of all shock arrests came in October 2022, when Richard Allen, a local resident, whose name was nowhere near this case, he was on absolutely nobody's radar, was arrested. And this came after a volunteer working through the thousands of leads that the police had amassed in this case found a report about a man who told police that he was there on the day the girls vanished, but was cleared with no obvious reason as to why. And this volunteer was 100% right to be shocked by this, because Delphi is a small town, and the killer was most likely a local or at least someone who knew the area, because where the girls were killed wouldn't have been that easy for a stranger to navigate, let alone to feel comfortable enough to abduct two girls in broad daylight in.
So logically, in this small town, filter down to the men and then those who would be the right age, so not children or old people, then those who have the right physical appearance when compared to Bridge Guy, because the killer is almost certainly Bridge Guy, that's not a particularly large pool of people. And Richard Allen should rightly have been at least in the top five suspects just from the mere fact that he was there that day. But whether Richard Allen is Bridge Guy is the key question at the heart of this whole case.
But for now, before we get to that, let's stick with this volunteer. They had found this man who fit all of these things, and he admitted to the police that he had been at the park and on the bridge the day the girls vanished. At first, he said that he had been there between 1 and 1:30, exactly when the girls were there. But then, when the police questioned him later, he changed his story, and now he said he had left by 12:30. So before the girls arrived.
The police searched his house and they found a bullet and a gun. There was also a box cutter, a knife and a blue jacket similar to the one worn by Bridge Guy in the video. But there was no blood found on any of these items. And yes, it had been 5 years, But investigators also couldn't match the injuries on the girls to these tools either.
The gun became the key reason the police arrested Richard Allen, because they were certain that they could link it to a cartridge that had been found at the scene between Abby and Libby's bodies. And at first, they seemingly did have a match. But this goes on to become a key part of the trial controversy, so hold on to your hats for that one. For now, let's get on with the trial. It finally started in mid-October 2025 and lasted just 19 days. When I first heard this, I was shocked by how short a time that was for a trial, especially for a case that was so high profile and involving a double child homicide. But when you realise a few things about the trial, it quickly becomes very clear why it was so short.
Let's have a look at what convicted Richard Allen. From what we can tell, it boils down to four things. Number one, he placed himself at the bridge around the time the girls vanished, and he admitted this to the police on the day the girls disappeared. Number two, Richard Allen does look like Bridge Guy. Number three, he had a gun and ammunition which was at least consistent with the cartridge found at the scene. And yes, we are going to tell you, don't worry about it. And number four, finally, and most damningly of all, Richard Allen confessed. And if you believe the prosecution, he confessed about 60 times. So what's the problem? Points one and two about him being there and looking like Bridge Guy are important. Richard Allen admits that he was on the path that day, which is a big red flag. And some people ask, if he is guilty, why did he tell the police that? Well, perhaps if he did do it, it was because he thought he'd been seen and he wanted to keep one step ahead of the game.
But interestingly, none of the witnesses that the prosecution put on the stand could say that the man they saw near the bridge on the day at the time was definitely Richard Allen. In fact, they all say wildly different things, giving descriptions that are, in some cases, the polar opposite of Richard Allen. They describe the man that they saw as tall, muscly, handsome, with curly hair. Richard Allen is short, not particularly muscly, I would say more rotund, especially back then. I wouldn't say he's particularly handsome from, like, even a subjective point. And he was bald, or nearly bald. So none of this fits. In fact, that description matches the police's first sketch of the suspect. Please refer to our two-parter for more information on this. And what's really interesting, if you guys remember that there were two sketches that looked completely different, the prosecution actually fought to get that first sketch, which is the police's sketch, so their own sketch, disallowed from court. Because they said the first one doesn't look like Richard Allen, and they didn't want to include it and mislead or confuse the jury. This is something you're going to hear several times throughout this episode. Then there's the bullet and the gun. As we said, at the crime scene, police found an unspent cartridge laying between the two girls' bodies. It turned out that the cartridge had been cycled through a gun, but not fired. So basically someone has just pushed it into the gun and cycled it through the chamber, making that ch-ch sound, possibly in an attempt to scare the girls, because remember, the girls weren't shot. There was just a cartridge found at the scene, suggesting that maybe a gun was involved. A ballistics expert took the stand for the prosecution and said that she had tested the cartridge found at the scene against the gun found in Richard Allen's home, and she said it was a match. So she said the gun found in Richard Allen's home produces the same markings on a cartridge as the cartridge found at the scene. So it's a match. But, and there's a big but here, her work seems a little bit shaky. Firstly, when she cycled a bullet through Richard Allen's gun, she didn't get the same markings. She didn't really get any markings at all. And so she couldn't match them to the cartridge found at the scene. So then, she put another cartridge in the gun and fired the gun. And then used the evidence of the fired bullet as the evidence to make a match to the unspent cartridge found at the scene. Those are two different things. When you fire a gun, there is added heat, there is added pressure, the markings are going to be more intense. It just doesn't feel like it's a close enough situation. And we're not the only ones to think that, because when images of the bullet that this ballistics expert had tested and the one from the scene, the cartridge from the scene, was shown to jurors at trial, the defense pointed out that they didn't really seem to match at all. But she just said that those pictures were just there for her to remember her notes, and that the jury should just take her word for it that they do indeed match. And look, there is a lot of complicated stuff out there. There are a lot of people who have done very, very big deep dives into this, people who understand guns, particularly on YouTube. I'm not an expert, but it isn't clear. Even the best legal minds that I have followed on this case who have talked about it don't seem to be clear as to what was actually going on in the courtroom, whether this ballistics expert's evidence can be believed, if it was clearly explained enough to the jury. All of that still seems to be a question mark. And if it's still a question mark for people who were at the trial and witnessed this, then it kind of does call into question the validity of all of it. And on top of this, the defense's expert was not allowed to testify because they weren't deemed to have the right level of expertise to comment on this topic. But this kind of tool mark analysis is controversial. It's like blood spatter or teeth mark evidence. And the defense should have been allowed to say that, but they weren't. And remember, this is the reason the gun they found at Richard Allen's house is the reason that he was arrested, because they so strongly believed that they could link the cartridge at the scene and the gun in Richard Allen's house together. And it doesn't seem that it is as clear-cut as they would have liked it to be.
Let's leave the guns behind us for a moment and talk about Richard Allen's confessions, the so-called 60 of them. Up until this point, it's pretty much 50-50. Some jurors may have bought into the ballistics analysis. Some of them might think that Richard Allen does look like Bridge Guy, some of them might not. But 60 confessions, that is quite difficult to explain away. When Richard Allen's house was searched, he made a comment, "It's over," to the police. And those do sound like the words of a guilty man.
Yeah, he says something to the effect of, like, what's the point? It's over. He's resigned to the fact that they're going to find something.
But then, when arrested, Richard Allen was adamant that he had nothing to do with the two murders. He denied and denied and denied and kept saying, "I will not confess to something I didn't do." But then later he does confess, again and again and again, to lots of different people, including to his own wife and his mum. So surely that's a done deal.
But how would it change your opinion at all if you knew that these confessions only started after Richard Allen was placed in a maximum security prison in solitary confinement, where he stayed for 13 months? Yes, you heard that correctly. A pre-trial detainee, whom in the eyes of the law is still innocent until proven guilty, was placed in solitary confinement in a maximum security prison for 13 months. It's unbelievable. He should have been in, like, a county jail. But instead, Richard Allen was held in the same cell for the entire 13 months. He was allowed out just 3 times a week for an hour at a time, and he had 1 visit to the prison psychiatrist a month. During this time, Richard Allen was also under 24-hour surveillance, and his behaviour became erratic.
Every single one of the next 59 confessions came after Richard Allen had been moved into solitary confinement.
And that's if you count his statement of "it's over" as a confession.
Richard Allen is a man with a long history of depression and anxiety. And in prison, it looks like he had a full-on breakdown. I fucking would too. He's seen on CCTV footage urinating on his bed, drinking toilet water, smearing feces on the walls, and eating his own feces as well. Some of the confessions he gave are vague. He says things like, "I'm ready to confess. Fuck you, Ryan. Who is Ryan? We don't know." And also things like, "Foxy lady, foxy, foxy, foxy." I think it's very obvious that he's completely lost it.
Yeah.
Now, it's so interesting, isn't it, how it's such a consistent behaviour of people in solitary confinement to smear poo on the walls.
Yeah.
Really interesting.
Yeah. Now, I do have to say that 3 of the confessions that Richard Allen made during this time do seem more lucid. For example, he told Dr. Waller, who's the prison psychiatrist, very specific things, like what he did on the day of the murders. He explains that he was going to rape the girls, but that a van drove past and startled him, so he just killed them. And the police actually found a witness who said that he drove his van down the road by where the girls were killed that day at around the same time. Bingo, right? Because this is a piece of information that only the killer could have known. Well, The problem is, the police had this witness before Richard Allen said this, and we know that he had access to discovery. So there's no evidence that he knew something only the killer could have known. He could have just read about it in discovery.
Also, in an FBI interview, the man told agents that he actually didn't come straight home that day, so it couldn't have been him. At trial, the defense tried to get this FBI agent to testify, and he said that he would, but that because of another case, he would only testify via video, and the judge wouldn't allow that. Don't know why.
Don't know why. Why is that controversial to allow an FBI agent to testify via video link? Like, he's literally stuck in Texas on another case. He's like, I can't come, but I will do this. Strange behavior. So let's move on from that and let's talk about Richard Allen confessing to his mum and his wife. And these confessions do definitely sound less psychotic. And in one call, when he's saying these things to his mum, she says, just because you think something doesn't mean it's true. To which Richard Allen replies, it is if you did it. But again, the issue here is that all of these confessions do come after the solitary confinement. And, crucially, after the prison psychiatrist started treating Richard Allen for psychosis. She officially diagnosed him and started giving him weekly shots of Haldol, a powerful antipsychotic. So, whether you think Richard Allen is guilty or not, we cannot skirt away from the question of, do you take these confessions seriously? Either he was crazy, like psychotic crazy, in which case, are they legit? Or, as the prosecution tried to claim, was he malingering? That's what they say. But if that's true, why then were you shooting up with Haldol every week if you thought he was pretending to be crazy? Also, Dr. Waller has found herself in quite a bit of hot water recently after it was revealed that she was absolutely obsessed with this case. She was in various Facebook groups, community chat forums, talking about this case, and that all just went further to undermine her credibility.
I mean, that should cost her a fucking career. That's terrible. Anyway, next up, DNA. There wasn't any. The police had no physical evidence tying Richard Allen, or anyone else for that matter, to the two murders, which is quite shocking for such a bloody set of killings. So you'll see people saying online that Richard Allen's DNA isn't there, so therefore he can't have done it, but someone did it, and their DNA isn't there either.
Yeah, so it's kind of like an irrelevant point, I think, with the DNA. But it does lead us on to the important question of third-party culpability, which is an absolutely crucial part of this trial, because this is where things get interesting. The police, in the 5 years after the murders and before they arrested Richard Allen, had multiple suspects in their crosshairs. They even worked on the theory that it was multiple killers until they arrested Richard Allen, at which point they swiftly said, no, it's this one guy and he acted alone. Yet the judge ruled that the defense was not allowed to introduce any other potential suspects, so they weren't allowed to make the claim of third-party culpability. They weren't allowed to point the finger at anyone else, which is bonkers.
Look, we've never bought into the Odinist stuff, and if you're interested in finding out more about that, you can go to our update, which is exclusively about that. But unbelievably, the prosecution managed to get any mention of the Odinism theory banned from being mentioned at trial, claiming again that it would mislead or confuse the jury. Which does seem quite mad. Are we now saying that if a theory's too crazy, it can just be ignored in a court of law? It doesn't really make too much sense.
Because if it's so stupid and so unbelievable, and I do agree that the Odinism stuff is pretty out there, why are you banning it? Let the defense bring it up. And they should have every right to do so, especially because, and this is very important, the Odinist theory was the police's working theory at one point. The defense didn't pull it out of nowhere. It's in the police's own notes that they looked into this theory. Yet now the judge is banning the defense from bringing it up at trial. That is wild. So banning this from being brought up at trial, when the public already knows all about the Odinist theory, just makes it look like a cover-up or a conspiracy. Anytime the public knows something that the courts don't allow the jury to hear, people are going to feel like it wasn't a fair trial.
And the Odinist stuff certainly is weird and probably wouldn't have made too much of a difference anyway. But there were other viable suspects. Kegan Klein, Brad Holder, and Elvis Fields, to name but a few. But again, the defence just weren't allowed to bring up any of these men at trial. Klein, who we covered in detail in our two-parter, was catfishing Libby and in contact with her in the days leading up to her murder. He also told police that his dad had been in the cemetery near the Monon High Bridge the day the girls were killed. And that's a cemetery that you can get to via the bridge.
Yeah, like literally if you look at it in trial, the defence asked one of the prosecution witnesses who's a law enforcement officer, it might have even been the sheriff, is there any other way onto the bridge? Because people are talking about having seen bridge guy or having seen somebody, a man walking the normal trials to get onto the bridge. Is there any other way? And he just goes, an unapproved one. He means the cemetery. From the cemetery, you can get onto the bridge. And Kegan Klein literally says his dad was there. Again, I don't know if this is all bullshit, but how can none of this have been allowed to be brought up at trial when Kegan Klein was a serious person of interest for the police?
Is that common, though, to... I don't know if a defence can be like, but look at all of the evidence about this guy.
They can absolutely bring up third-party culpability if they have enough evidence to back it up. It's like we talked about with the Karen Reed case. They can't just bring up third-party culpability and say it's some random person. But when the police themselves investigated this, you could bring that up because then the police should be able to say, this is why we cleared those people. So third-party culpability, yeah, you can't just pull it out of your arse and point the finger at any random Tom, Dick and Harry. But these were all people the police investigated, and yet none of this was allowed to be brought up, which is very strange. Then we have Elvis Fields. He's a man who the police looked into and who confessed to his sisters that he had killed Abby and Libby. Their sister called the police. Fields even asked police after submitting a DNA sample if he could explain why his spit was found on the girls, would he still get in trouble? He later told a different sister that he had spat on one of the girls after they were killed and called Abby a troublemaker. The police ruled Fields out because there was no DNA evidence on the girls that linked him to them and because his mental capacity was in question. And you do have to question again. I'm not here saying Richard Allen is innocent, but no DNA evidence and questions about mental capacity, other than the gun, which is also very much called into question, they don't have much more on Richard Allen. Then there was Brad Holder, who made weird comments online about the murders. Again, we go into detail about Brad in our two-parter. But still, the jury heard none of this.
The idea that perhaps there could have been more than one person responsible for the murders was also something the defence weren't allowed to discuss at trial. And of course, Richard Allen could have committed the murders by himself. But there is some stuff that doesn't fit. Like the fact that blood had dripped down from the girls' throats rather than to the side. And if you couple that with the fact that Abby and Libby had no defensive wounds and none of their own blood on their hands, surely it feels like they were sat up with their arms held down while their throats were cut. And how could one man have done that?
Yeah, look, I'm not here to say it's one person or multiple people for sure, but there are question marks that make it feel like it could have been more than one person. And there is one more thing. This is what we mentioned earlier about what else was on that video that Libby had recorded. So in that video footage, Libby at one point is speaking to somebody. She's speaking out loud. But Abby, who is in the video footage, and Bridge Guy, who's also in the video footage at that point, are too far away for her to be speaking to them. There's no way they could have heard her. So some people have questioned, who's she speaking to? Is she speaking to somebody else who's behind her or next to her? Or perhaps she could also just be speaking to the camera to herself. She was documenting it. It's not clear because we don't know what was said. But that could mean that somebody else was there. We just don't know. So this trial has also been very hard in terms of public and media access. It's been heavily, heavily restricted. Firstly, no TV cameras were allowed into the courtroom. And they also picked a courtroom with only 26 seats for the public gallery. For a case as high profile as this, that does seem very, very small. And again, it's just going to add to the questions and suspicions that people have around the fairness of the trial if they feel like the public's access to it, if transparency is lacking. So all of this, plus the evidence that was excluded that the public knew about, makes the public not trust the result at all. And we're seeing it in all of the comments that are flying around online.
So let's put this all together. The fact that Richard Allen was there that day, and the confessions that he gives are probably what pushed the jury to go with a guilty verdict. But other people also confessed, and the judge also suppressed the geofencing evidence, which we discussed in our two-parter.
Yeah, so if you guys listened to that episode, we talked about geofencing and how in rare occasions, especially if a crime is committed within a very small area and not densely populated area, that the police can get the green light to do geofencing, which is to get all of the cell phone data of anybody who was in the area at the time. Then they can look at that list and see who could potentially be a suspect. That list was collated by the police. We haven't seen it. It's never been released. And it was suppressed from being entered at trial. So basically, the defense can't even say, look, you're saying it was Richard Allen because he was there and he confessed. We know other people confessed. We don't know who else was there. Who else could have matched this? Who else matched that sketch that you also suppressed? Who was this person that other people saw? Was Kegan Klein's dad there? All of that was suppressed. So again, it makes people feel very suspicious. So what do we think? Honestly, I don't know. But the question is, did the state prove that it was Richard Allen beyond a reasonable doubt? And did he get a fair trial? I think the issue for me is that the prosecution didn't really have anything super solid linking Richard Allen to Bridge Guy. Yes, Richard Allen was in the area. And yes, he looks like Bridge Guy. And yes, he confessed, but so did other people. And also the confessions came as he was diagnosed as being psychotic. And any lawyer worth their salt will argue that the treatment Richard Allen received in prison is what pushed him to confess. Whether you believe that or not, whether you believe he was malingering, but they're also shooting him up with Haldol, they will make that argument. And there are also alleged pictures of Richard Allen in prison with a bag over his head and essentially being tortured. So is this all enough? Just the confessions that are questionable, the gun, which is questionable, and the fact that he bears a resemblance to Bridge Guy, is that all enough for a court of law to convict someone of a double homicide? That's the question.
It's purely a circumstantial case. And sure, circumstantial evidence is evidence, but what the prosecution have is pretty weak. And we're not saying that Richard Allen didn't do it, but when it comes to justice, the ends can't justify the means. Process is important, and ensuring a fair trial is the most important of all, transparency included. And this is a great test case, a microcosm of how justice should be achieved. And the precedent that the state can send someone to a max security prison and put them in solitary pre-trial is absolutely terrifying.
So we have to ask ourselves, what does justice mean? I think for justice to be done, truly done, you have to get the right person, but you have to get them in the right way. They have to be convicted in a fair trial. And I don't know, from everything I've read, I'm not entirely sure that's what happened here. People might disagree. I'm just giving my opinion. Some people are convinced that the police and the prosecution are railroading Richard Allen. And I don't know about that. I think there were better candidates that they could have railroaded. Like, why wouldn't you go after Kegan Klein? Kegan Klein and his dad had like previous for all sorts of like weird child-related molestation charges. That would have been a far easier sell to any jury.
I remember after we did the two-parter, I was like, yep, sign me up.
Yep. I think the police and the prosecution really believe that Richard Allen is the killer, and maybe he is. But the whole thing is so totally fucked. I think if you go and listen to this case on YouTube, other podcasters, other people talking about this, you'll find a lot of people who worked as defense attorneys who'll be like, this is outrageous. And you will also find a lot of people who worked on the prosecution side being like, this is outrageous. But I think the one thing everybody agrees on is that this does not feel like a fair trial. That seems to be the overarching consensus, whichever side people land on in terms of Richard Allen's guilt. Now, how did this happen? I think there is a lot of incompetence that was going on. And you know, it's very difficult with such an emotional case where two young girls were brutally murdered. But it was a small town, and I think they found themselves drowning under the pressure of an unexpectedly mega high-profile case without all of the resources and expertise that they needed to deal with this properly.
So we're just going to have to wait and see what happens. Richard Allen's sentencing is scheduled for the 20th of December, but that will not be the end. The appeals will be kicking off soon after. And he does have a pretty solid case. I do wonder, though, because he's absolutely fucking nuts now. whether he'll bother.
Yeah, it's hard to know what will happen.
The defence are currently putting together a case file on all of the evidence for third-party culpability, and that could be used at an appeal if one happens, with the appellant judge being able to see what the evidence would have been.
And there are a lot of people out there rooting for these appeals to take place and for Richard Allen to win these appeals. And look, I get it. It's very hard to look at this trial and not feel like, what the actual fuck? But if he did it, and he may well have, but he gets out on appeal, then the state and the police investigation are entirely to blame because of this terrible trial. But if he didn't do it and he gets out, then good for Richard Allen. But Abby and Libby's families will never, ever, ever get justice if that happens, because the state will never be able to prosecute anybody else. Because all that person would have to do is point to the state's own case against Richard Allen and say, how are you going to prosecute me when you were so sure it was him? And that's case dead. So yeah, that is our update on the Delphi trial. Like I said, this is nowhere near over. We're going to be going into appeals. All sorts going to happen, probably. Let's see.
Yeah. I mean, lasting over a year in solitary is insanity. Like,
yeah,
that kills people.
Yeah. And I think if it had gone on any longer, it probably would have killed Richard Allen. So look, I really, really want to make it clear. This is about Libby and Abby and them getting justice, but it really comes down to the fact that you have to get justice in the right way, or you're going to leave yourself open to all sorts of appeals and controversy, which is exactly what's happened here. So that's it, guys. I know there's going to be a lot of opinions on this. I don't know what I think. Let's leave it at that. And we'll see you next time for another update, another episode, another all sorts of things. But go listen to our two-parter. Go listen to the update on Odinism for the full story. This was just a very quick rundown.
Yeah. Keep your poo to yourself also.
Bye.
Bye.